This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And welcome to episode 15 of Strong Style History here at Place to Be Nation, the Pro Wrestling Only Board podcast feed. I'm the host, Jeffrey Wessel. You can find me at Strong Style Story without the E in style on Twitter. And I run the Strong Style Story blog and podcast at strongstylestory.tumblr.com. With me today are my usual co-host, Lawrence O'Brien, and our not usual co-host, but constant producer, Chris Damasceno. Lawrence, Chris, how are you today?
I'm swell. I feel like I just ate enough pizza to like explode, but I mean, I'm also I'm good.
Clearly, a very productive afternoon for you in that case. I mean, pizza is always a good thing. I'm just saying.
Oh, New Haven pizza is always a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. Pizza is delicious.
This is a very pizza snob area right now. So.
Oh boy.
New Haven pizza.
Oh boy, the pizza community. The pizza community.
I am the leader of said community, and yeah. So.
Before we begin our regular topic, we just like to take a few words to commemorate the recent passing of Masa Saito, born Masanori Saito. He passed away earlier this week at the age of 75. Of course, you know, his accomplishments are many and storied, including, you know, at one time he was the American Wrestling Association World Heavyweight Champion. For our part, we have discussed Masa Saito on this show, and we were not kind, as this was back in episode 5 when Lawrence and I discussed the Island Death matches. We were not kind to the matches, but it in no way takes away what the meaning and significance of Masa Saito to the history of New Japan Pro Wrestling and pro wrestling in general. So, Lawrence and Chris, if you have any words you'd like to say regarding Saito.
I think...
You go first, please. Fine. Chris.
Of course. For me, personally, with Saito, not a whole lot of experience outside of watching a couple of older things here and there. Obviously, his stuff with Inoki with the Island Death match being very predominant, at least for like an earlier impression of him, as you mentioned. But he did quite a lot of things throughout his time. I mean, AWA, a little bit of time in WCW as well. I think the part for me that's sad about this death is that he was training to actually be a torchbearer for the Olympics in another 2 years now, which is just...
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, and he had been fighting Parkinson's disease since 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's
and
just...
And he was going to get through that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lest we forget, you know, he also was a two-time WWF World Tag Team Champion with Mr. Fuji.
Right, mm-hmm.
In addition to being part of the infamous incident with Ken Patera, but it seems like a lot of times, in modern times, when discussing Saito, you discuss either the Saito suplex, which of course he innovated,
yeah, mm-hmm.
or you know, any of the bad things, i.e. the jail time for the, you know, his part in the Ken Patera at McDonald's.
Oh, yeah. My favorite.
Or the Island Death matches. So, at a future time, I think we here at Strong Style History want to make up for that, and we'll do our due diligence and research a topic that will, you know, paint Saito in a better light than perhaps what we've presented him as on this show.
He and Hogan had the big rivalry in the AWA there too before Hogan jumped ship.
Oh, that's true. And of course, both of them were trained by Hiro Matsuda.
Right, correct. Yep, that is a big link. That and I know Hogan is still very, very grateful to like Matsuda and like how he trained him and everything too. So
I believe. But as I recall, I think it was because he was trained by Matsuda. That's what, and it was Matsuda that led him to Inoki, and that's why Hogan remained so loyal to New Japan, even when the companies he was working with were working with All Japan, as was the case when Hogan was back in the AWA. But I'm sure Saito had a lot to do with that as well.
Right, and Saito even worked in the WWF for a little bit. I mean, you know, he was tag champs with Mr. Fuji, and he was like a little bit of everywhere. You know, he America and over in Japan. So like he made the rounds.
He did indeed, and I do appreciate that. You know, even though there are those out there that like to say that Bushiroad is trying to erase the history of New Japan, but that doesn't seem to be borne out in the evidence, because they did perform a 10-bell ceremony for him earlier this week at the beginning of one of the Korakuen Hall shows for G1 Climax. So even even with this new regime of Harold May and working underneath Takaaki Kidani, New Japan did recognize Saito's contributions. And I'm not sure if All Japan did anything similar. I'm sure that they did. I know that they ran shows this week too, but I just didn't see if they did. So regardless, coming soon to Strong Style History, we will do a more in-depth and more flattering portrayal of a time for Masa Saito. So, moving on to our topic for this month, currently in New Japan Pro Wrestling, we are in the midst of the 28th running of G1 Climax, the yearly heavyweight round-robin tournament that usually tends to set the stage for the rest of the New Japan year going into Wrestle Kingdom on the January 4th Tokyo Dome show. Today we're going to take a look at the very first running of G1 Climax, which was in 1991. However, this was not the first tournament that New Japan ever ran. So let's, if we're ready to go on this.
This was like, the first round. It was funny because like the first one was like a round robin, like it always has been. But then for like the next like 2 years, it wasn't actually.
That's true. It did go to a single elimination format at one point. However,
for a couple
of
years in a row.
It did start as a round robin, and the lineage of this actually we had to go back to 1974 as far as New Japan Pro Wrestling goes.
Because
there were different heavyweight tournaments held annually, under different names.
World League, right?
1974, the 1977 was called the World League, which was actually taken from the old JWA, the Japan Wrestling Association, used to be the big World League.
Yep.
Back then. Then from 1978 to 1982, it became the MSG League. Before, in 1983 through 1988, the tournament was called the International Wrestling Grand Prix League, from which we do get the initials IWGP. It should be noted, however, that despite the fact that Hulk Hogan did win that first tournament and was awarded a championship belt as his trophy, he is not considered an IWGP heavyweight champion.
Yeah, that's oddly enough. It's like
oddly enough, yeah. That is one belt he never held, was the IWGP heavyweight title.
God.
And then finally, in 1989, there was the World Cup tournament, which folded in wrestlers from the then Soviet Union.
Oh yeah.
So you had wrestlers, including Zangief, from which we get the Street Fighter II character, Zangief. That came from Zangief actually existed, and but they did not held any sort of tournament in 1990. And then we come around to 1991 during the presidential reign of Seiji Sakaguchi. And during this time, Inoki's dominance was waning. Inoki usually won these annual tournaments, but now was the time. Now came the time to start pushing some of the younger talents and newer talents. So Seiji Sakaguchi named that tournament G1 Climax or Grade 1 Climax after the Grade 1 horse race.
Huh. I did not know that.
Yeah, that is interesting.
That I did not know.
Yes. It is considered a continuation of previous tournaments. However, in this time period, New Japan, and starting from the G1 Climax branding, New Japan ceased recognizing the tournament lineage. And that will come into play later on when we discuss this, the initial G1 Climax, which ran from August 7th until August 11th of 1991. Mm-hmm. So,
a little shorter time period than it is now.
Yeah,
it was a little shorter time period and a lot less participants than we currently have. However, the same basic format remains: 2 points for a win, 1 point for a draw, and 0 points for a loss. So as we were used to, it was only eight wrestlers, but four wrestlers apiece, divided into two different blocks. In Block A were the following: Tatsumi Fujinami, who by that time, he was would have been considered a young lion at the beginning of New Japan Pro Wrestling, but that was 19 years previously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was the current IWGP Heavyweight Champion at the time too, I believe.
Yes, I think you're correct on that.
Mm-hmm.
Big Van Vader, who, by that point was not a plucky young
And
of course he also had recently passed, but we discussed that on Strong Style Story recently.
Oh, Vader was right in his prime here, though. This is like getting
this was prime. Scott Norton, favorite around these parts, and of course my favorite wrestler of all time, Keiji Muto. In Block B was a bit more interesting. Block B featured Riki Shoshu,
who was booking at the time,
hardly a young gun. Yes, which leads to something very interesting that occurs during this tournament. During Shoshu's booking, and Muto's mates as the Three Musketeers, Masahiro Chono and Shinya Hashimoto. The fourth participant went under the name Crusher, but we all know him as Bam Bam Bigelow.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we had quite a bit of talent in these in this early G1 Climax.
Bam Bam is legit one of my all-time favorite wrestlers. Like,
as well he should be. He was
I don't talk about enough.
Yeah, Bam Bam was pretty underappreciated in his time. It has to be said.
He got an amazing match out of Lawrence Taylor. Like, I think we all need to like really sit back and like appreciate that. Like,
this is true.
That man got a freaking like 4-star match out of Lawrence Taylor, and like that, I cannot commend that enough. That's like, that was honestly impressive. That was. That was in the nice old state of Connecticut, by the way.
a little bit of local pride there.
Hartford, Connecticut, which will never see another WrestleMania ever again.
Well, neither will Indianapolis, probably. So.
Yeah, probably not either. Yeah.
Chris, I don't know. You're in Denver. I don't know if they've ever hosted a WrestleMania.
No,
I'm pretty sure
it'll probably never happen because of the time of the year and how cold it normally is around this time of the year there. So
elevation.
Like, yeah, uh-huh, exactly.
Yeah. But,
can't have people dying from elevation.
But we digress. So, the tournament ran, as mentioned, from August 7th until August 11th of 1991. They did not, but the shows that they were running, they did not name this the G1 Climax Tour. It was just a tournament that ran through shows. So the first night,
I noticed the first night
was on August 7th, 1991, and at the Aichi Professional Gymnasium in Nagoya for NJPW Summer Night Fever in Nagoya.
Yep.
And on that show, we had the first four block matches, both B and A block, ran at the same time, something that never happens anymore.
Oh, yeah, and just a preface, like, unfortunately, like, basically, of this tournament, the final was, like, the only thing that got televised, I believe.
Yeah, I remember seeing clips a long time ago.
I feel like there was probably
back in the tape trading days.
Yeah,
I tried to find the only footage that's on NJPW World from this tournament is the final. I tried to find other sources, but I failed in that. So, but
yeah,
I think there was a lot of
clips. I think it was more of just probably clips from like Samurai. Probably had highlights at the time. I don't even know if it was like full.
I don't think it was even Samurai if we're talking 1991.
Yeah, no, probably not Samurai, but yeah, like
TV Asahi.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It would have been on a random, you know, World Pro Wrestling show.
Right.
I tried to find it and I could not. But regardless, 1991 G1 Climax Final is on NJPW World, and we will talk about that in greater detail coming up. So to start with, we'll start with the A-block matches that happened that day on August the 7th, 1991. In the first match, Tatsumi Fujinami beat Big Van Vader.
Wow, yeah, that must have been an interesting match.
I know that Fujinami and Vader have had matches, you know, had a few matches between them.
Mm.
But and then also in Block A, Scott Flash Norton defeated Keiji Mudo.
Which is interesting, because Mudo actually ends up going to the final.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, but, thanks, Lawrence. but since there was only two matches, we go to Block B now, and Shinya Hashimoto beat Bam Bam Bigelow. That's a clash of big men right
See,
there.
See, this is why I am so upset this is not on New Japan World, because that match, this match has my, like, name written all over it.
This does seem like a very Lawrence match.
Yeah, it's the Bam quintessential Bam Lawrence O'Brien match right there, to be honest with you.
This is like, yes, give me this.
Oh, I'm sure there's clips out there somewhere. I like I said, I swear I remember seeing clips of tournament matches and then the full final, but again, that was back in the tape trading days and I couldn't find anything online. So to round out, you know, the G1 Climax matches from Summer Night Fever in Nagoya, Masahiro Chono would defeat Riki Choshi, the booker.
Oh.
So, yeah, keep this in mind. Now, also keep in mind that in Nagoya, the Aichi Professional Gymnasium, when this took place, currently, as we record, is the last day of the July Sumo Ba show, which took place in Aichi Prefectural Gymnasium.
Yeah.
Why this is significant is because the rest of G1 Climax, as it traditionally does, although this year is not the case due to renovations going on in there, it takes place at Ryogoku Kokugikan in Tokyo, the Sumo Hall. And there is a bit of a sumo influence on this tournament, as we'll discuss. So moving on to the second day of the tournament, which happened on August the 9th of 1991.
Wow. I just ended up looking up to see, like, just in case on New Japan World, if they had the Hosh Bam Bam match on there. And a couple matches came up that I had no idea were on here and that I need to watch. One being from March 2nd, 1990, Masa Saito and Hashimoto versus Bam Bam, and a guy named Punisher Dice Morgan, who we better may know as The Undertaker.
Oh, my goodness. Give us a link to that one when you can. I may have to see this one.
Mean Mark Callis.
Mean Mark Callis.
Whatever you want to call him. Yeah, this at the time, he was, I guess he was Punisher Dice Morgan at this point. And, but yeah, that's on here, which is pretty crazy. And so there's unfortunately no Hosh and Bam Bam single stuff, but there's also another interesting one is Koji Kitao, Shinya Hashimoto, and Masa Saito versus Vader, Bam Bam, and Steve Williams, believe it or not.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, Steve Williams is rare in a rare New Japan appearance.
Well, that's certainly something to look forward to on later viewings. But
yeah.
For now, we go back to Kokugikan in Tokyo. So on August the 9th, and this was there was a 3-day tour, residency in Sumo Hall. It was called NJPW Violent Storm in Kokugikan.
That is the coolest event name ever.
It's up there.
Violent
Storm. I'll give it that.
Like, I love that.
So let's go to the block matches from that day. In A block, Keiji Muto would get his first 2 points by defeating Tatsumi Fujinami. Mm-hmm. Whereas Big Van Vader would beat Scott Norton by countout. Now this seems like a very odd result to me.
Oh man.
I can't quite put my finger on why, other than I should think that Vader, of all people, I mean, as powerful and as much of a big guy that Norton was, I would think that Vader would wash Norton.
I think that match must have spilled outside, and they would probably just beat the shit out of each other until the refs was just like, nope, this is it.
Well, you know, that's a possibility, too.
That's most likely what I think probably occurred in that match.
Yeah, probably. Chris, do you have any thoughts here?
I mean, I could see it as a way of just satisfying Vader to at least get him some points in the tournament, but at the same time that they needed this particular result to eventually set up what we're going to be talking about on the next set of matches within that block that led to the finalists in question.
Yes. So moving on to B block, as we're talking on August the 9th, day two of the tournament, Bam Bam Bigelow would beat Riki Choshu.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, so here the booker, Riki Choshu, known for not, for being a little selfish in his booking, especially with regards to his protege, Kensuke Sasaki, is eating L's here.
I know, that's crazy. Like, he booked himself to not win.
And then, also on that day, possibly the result of the tournament, which, again, sadly, we don't have footage of this.
Oh, I know. It's like
Masahiro Chono and Shinya Hashimoto, the two of the Musketeers that were in the same block, wrestled to a 30-minute time limit draw.
And this actually ends up leading to something pretty cool, and I don't and I don't think has happened again since that you got to might have to fact check me on, but I don't think there's been a point in G1 ever since then where there's been a rematch of the same two guys in the same tournament. And that is what happens in B block because of this decision.
I will have to look at that. That's not true.
Okay.
You said rematch of the same two guys. Now, there have been decision matches, but it looks like in 99, there was a decision match, but it wasn't because they faced each other and there was a draw.
Right, that's what I mean.
In that case, in 1999, Keiji Muto and Yuji Nagata wrestled a decision match for Block A, which Muto would win, but then fall to Manabu Nakanishi in the final. When they wrestled in the block, Nagata fell to Muto.
You don't see it much. It's not something you see much.
That's true.
And especially because of that they did the draw, and that's interesting.
Right, and I'm looking, and as I look at this, there was in 2000, there was a decision match. There were two decision matches because this was the year that they split it up into four blocks.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right.
And yeah, so there was there were two decision matches in that case.
Oh.
So decision matches wouldn't be, but I think you are correct I had to check every instance, but I think you are correct in that there was a decision match because of the guys in the decision match had actually wrestled to a draw earlier in the tournament. I think you might actually be right on that,
For Block B? Because, yes. Chono and Hashimoto did wrestle to a 30-minute draw in the final match of their block and then had to have that decision on Block B.
Correct. You're right. So as we move along in on day two, so the day two results, everybody in Block A is squared at 2 points: Muto, Fujinami, Norton, and Vader. Whereas in Block B, Chono and Hashimoto lead the block, tied at 3, with Bigelow having 2 points and Choshu having 0.
Yeah.
So we move to the next day at Kokugi-kan. This is day two of Violent Storm in Kokugi-kan. We had another draw, not quite as epic as this one.
No.
Scott Norton and Tatsumi Fujinami go to a double countout
in less than 8 minutes.
With an official time of 7:56. So not quite a classic there.
Oh man.
But it served its purpose, as in the last match in Block A, Keiji Muto would beat Big Van Vader.
Wow.
The 13:54 mark. So Muto would win Block A by virtue of having 4 points. So we move on to Block B, and we have two people tied there to start, Chono and Hashimoto. Hashimoto defeats Riki Choshu in 7:50, leaving Choshu with a goose egg for the entire tournament. Which seems unthinkable, given, again, Choshu was the booker, and we all know about Riki Choshu.
Yeah.
And two big things that I want to talk about as well, too, just as takeaways from this. Remember, guys, this was 1991. Muto and Chono at that particular time, and Hashimoto as well, they were still establishing themselves within the ranks on that side of things. And I think at the time, not a lot of people would have probably considered Muto coming out of Block A, especially with the heavyweight champion Fujinami being there, and then the names like Norton and Vader with their big imposing presences. So it kind of was a big deal that Muto survived out of that block, obviously, and then you had the Chono Hashimoto bit to settle things eventually too. So
right, well, and then the final block match was Masahiro Chono beat Bam Bam Bigelow in 12:38.
Yeah,
which, so that led to both Hashimoto and Chono leading the block. So as we just discussed, we needed a decision match.
Yeah, which was on the same day of the G1 final.
So the decision match would take place at day 3 of Violent Storm in Kokugi-kan on August the 11th of 1991. And as I think we all know by now, Masahiro Chono would beat his fellow musketeer Shinya Hashimoto to move on to the final to face the third of the musketeers, Keiji Muto.
Yeah, now this is quite a showdown here.
Yes, and it was kind of an amazing showdown. So this was actually the main event of day 3 of Violent Storm and Kokugi-kan. The G1 climax matches were not necessarily the main events of their days on the other shows.
Yeah, I just don't think they thought this was going to be as big of a deal as it became. It kind of it kind of became bigger just over time. When it started here, you know, it wasn't, I don't think they considered it as like a huge deal.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, since, you know, again, 28, you know, G1 28 is going on.
Right. The branding and, just wasn't here yet, you know, for that. And it's just, they were just kind of on the other show. It was on the shows as like, you know, as, oh, it's the G1 part of the show.
Right.
Well,
and
now
it's
like
now it,
literally
now it, is
it revolves the around. Yes. These are dedicated shows to the G1. So.
Right. I mean, they took them a while to finally settle on a branding name, unlike All Japan, who seems to have pretty consistently used Champion Carnival throughout their history. You know, and there are many ownerships and tribulations. But getting back to G1 Final, I'm guessing all three of us have now watched this match. Probably not for the first time either.
No, I mean, I had seen it before, but it was a while ago, and I had to, like, give myself a refresher because it had been like quite a while. And like, then when this match started, the first 10 minutes of this match are not anything special. It's like there's a lot of rest holds, and I was like going like, ah, Jesus, this is another like Chono special again. I forgot. I'm like, oh no. But then
watch it.
Like, here we go. But things take a drastic turn when at one point Muto is getting up, and then all of a sudden Chono just decides to like kick him in the head like 3-4 times, just like boots him in the head when he's trying to get up.
Couple Kenka kicks.
Yeah, and just
the good old Kenka kick.
And that's when shit starts to go down in this match, and that is like where this takes a drastic turn.
Well, it should be noted at this. Let me note at this point. So as we start the match, we all have in our heads the images of both, you know, Masahiro Chono and Keiji Muto. At this time, Muto looked pretty clean cut and respectable whilst wearing orange and not bald. Yes, whilst wearing orange, you know, pretty much he was wearing orange gear. It kind of in a strange sort of way reminded me of Kenta Kobashi.
Yeah.
Since they both ride or died on the moonsault.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I mean it just kind of gave that image off. But meanwhile, Chono, we're all used to him being black on black everything.
Now this is a little before that.
Before that, where he was wearing white, you know, you know, half leg tights, very shiny. there was a lot of shininess to them. There were like sequins or something on there that was, you know, gave reflection. But then it also nonsensically says Tokyo, Japan in English on those tights. So
yes. This was before Masahiro Chono decided to drop Hot Beats.
yeah, that's right. He was going to drop the mixtape of the years. Of the decade here.
I mean, Fight and Love is like a guilty pleasure. I'm not going to even lie about this, you guys.
So anyway, so we get back to this. And yes, after about the 10-minute mark, Chono and Muto put on a show.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
to say the least.
I should know the crowd was... They were chanting for Chono the whole way.
Yeah.
Is in for Chono. Now, this will play into the very end of the match.
Yeah, Muto kind of actually really, once the Chono started, like, kicking him around, Muto just, like, kicked it into this, like, next gear, and he kind of, like, did some pretty, like nasty stuff. Like he ends up pile-driving Chono on the concrete on the outside.
Oh, yes.
Which is just an insane spot.
The boos were sounded out through Sumo Hall there. Yeah, Muto definitely went heel in this match at one point. And you know, he was used to that, you know, having, you know, done a lot of his tour of duty in the NWA is great Muto, of course.
Right.
Plus, there's also the story as well with that at that point in time, Muto had Chono's number pretty much every single time. At that point, Chono had not beaten him in singles.
Oh, that's right.
And the Japanese crowds do like to, you know, tend to chant for the underdog, which again will play into what we see at the very end of the match. But the there were some pile drivers beaten out in this match.
At one point, there is a spot in this match that is still, to me, like one of the most insane things I've ever seen. And it reminds me that, like, at one point, Keiji Muto actually had working patellar tendons. And, like, it's just, like, absolutely insane. I think Chono went for, was it a drop kick off the top rope? Or, I think... And Muto literally jumped over him in midair.
Yes.
Like, I was like...
amazing.
I, like, actually audibly, like, gasped when, like, he did that. I was like, how? Like, how did he just do that?
Yeah,
like,
I believe the way during the match at that point, Muto had landed at least one or two missile drop kicks, so Chono tried to anticipate it would have... dropped
all right.
a counter of his own, and that's why Muto did like the full leap over him at the time.
Yeah, and the big story of this in this too, speaking of that, was that Muto could not land the moonsault. Like he tried multiple times. Like I think it was either two or three times. In the last one, led to his demise in this. But he was trying to put Muto, you know, Chono away with it like quickly.
Yeah, and let's talk about his demise, because of course, you know, Chono's signature move has always been the STF.
Right.
And that didn't work.
Yep.
He could not put Muto away with the STF, so he ended up just doing a very Kawada like powerbomb.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was, and like even before the finish too, like they kind of were trading off their holds on each other. Like I know Muto went for the Muto lock and he got out of it, and then like he put locked in the SDF, and like you said, he couldn't get that either. And then they like put octopus stretches on each other, and it was
dueling Manji Gatames were something else.
I was like, holy shit, like man, it's like that match, like it went from like it was the kind of just a pedestrian pace at the beginning to just like a whoa, like where did this come from? All of a sudden they're just like killing each other. And yeah, I forgot how good this match was. And the most hilarious thing about this match, and I still to this day find it so funny, is that they had this great match and then later in the year went to WCW and absolutely stunk up the joint. Like I mean stunk up the joint. And I mean that match they had in WCW rematch was just like god awful. One of the worst matches.
Which one was this? Because of course, you know, there's been plenty of classic Muto and Chono matches. Which match are you referring to?
Oh god, what show was this on? Hold on, give me a second. I'm sorry, this was a couple years later then.
Alright, well, yeah, if time goes on, then yeah, you can see where that might do that, yes.
I think it was a couple years later. It was when Chono, when Muto had the IWGP title and then Chono had the NWA title. And they faced each other on, what show was
it? Wait a minute, because that was a Tokyo Dome show, and that was like one of my favorite matches ever.
Oh, no. It was. Oh yeah, no, that was the. But yeah, they had a rematch in WCW that was like absolutely terrible.
Okay, well we'll have to table that one for another time. But you know, again, playing into the finish where they did try to do dueling, you know, their signature moves, and it didn't work. So then Chono just up and power bombs Muto for the finish.
Yeah.
It is like a very, very Toshiaki Kawada like powerbomb, although maybe still a few years before Kawada was really, you know, Kawada.
Yeah, right.
So I think we're still a few years away from that. I mean, I don't know if you can actually draw a straight line between the four pillars and the Three Musketeers. I don't think you really can. And this is kind of a side topic anyway. But we get to the finish. Masahiro Chono wins the inaugural G1 Climax, and the crowd goes bananas, throwing purple pillows at the ring.
Yeah, that's now, the pillows now, they sit on in the hall.
Yeah, this is a sumo tradition because we're in sumo hall. This is a sumo tradition. They usually do it in celebration. Usually when a Maegashira, which is the lowest rank before you're featured in the Grand Sumo tournaments, defeats a Yokozuna, which is the highest rank. Chono was definitely the underdog in this match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this was, he got a very underdog, you know, he got, this it amounts to what in sumo is called a Kinboshi, a gold star victory.
Yep.
Can you tell I watch sumo?
I can definitely tell, but
the
context is great here, because for the longest time, I had no idea why they were throwing the pillows.
Okay. Well, yeah, I just remembered.
I just remember, it was on Starrcade 92. I don't know how, I did not remember. It was later, it was in 92. It was the next year.
Starrcade 92, okay.
Yeah, they had a 13-minute match that was, absolutely unbearable. It was, the biggest snooze fest match I have, ever seen. It was horrible.
This was the Battle Bowl.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, wait a minute. According to this, according to what I've seen, it was Great Muta against Barry Windham in that.
Nope. That was, no. Starrcade 92 was a Battle Bowl. Chono had the NWA title.
Oh, here we go. Okay, so there were two. Okay, so Muta wrestled twice, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, and it was for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship at that time.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Yeah,
and because Muta wrestled before and had two matches, I think they just made the conscious decision to be we're gonna
mail this one in.
We are gonna
It turns out Muta wrestled three times on that.
Oh, that's that's
on Battle Bowl.
That's right. That's why they had this snooze fest of a match. I mean, they just sat on rest holds for 10 minutes,
okay,
and then they
all right. Well, you know what? I'm gonna say that they may have had a bad match, but then again, Muto would wrestle three times that night.
but also Chono had a history of doing this too. So I mean, Chono.
That's a debate I'm not prepared to have right now. But
Chono is very guilty of doing that too at times. So,
well, long story short, he did not do it in this match, and not at all. And this was a great celebration with the pillows flying, but you know, in sumo tradition, it was again Chono had basically gotten the Kinboshi for beating the higher ranked wrestler.
Yeah,
but so and then the ending sequence, of course, had all three Musketeers in the ring at once, and they were it was a beautiful moment, actually.
Yeah,
I think when you had Chono, Muto, and Hashimoto, three guys whose career would all take very different paths. I mean, they were all successful, but they took very different paths. But to see them together was just kind of a heart tugging moment.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I do remember
back those days when they were all together.
Yeah, I do think at this period of time, though, I think Chono at this point was at his best. For sure.
Well, this is clearly before, Steve Austin broke his neck.
Right, right. Yeah, after that, obviously, everything went downhill. I mean, was,
Well, it went downhill maybe in an in-ring perspective, but Chono was still one of the top draws, just, if not on his ring ability, which he still had, I think. He was hampered by the neck break. And
doubt, though. Chono was a cool-ass motherfucker.
He had charisma in spades, and I think that certainly helped him in his later career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt.
Post-neck,
I mean, because like both the G1 finals he was involved in, the first two were freaking awesome matches. So I mean,
yeah, and let's go through that too, because the long term effect of this would be Masahiro Chono. This would be end up being the first of a record 5
yep.
G1 climax wins, including being the only one to win consecutive G1 climaxes. Until
yep.
Hiroshi Tenzan would make yeah. his run. And in fact, Chono would in fact win 3 out of the first 4
yep.
G1 climaxes. Muto would finally get his, defeating Shinya Hashimoto in 1995's G1 climax.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's a story for another day, as is Muto would make several finals, but never win it again, including, in Muto's greatest year in 2001 when he fell to Yuji Nagata in that edition. The 10th running of G1 Climax,
yeah.
as it turns out. But long-term, I mean, this was, Men had run tournaments since 1974, and this was the branding and the tournament and the lineage that stuck.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know. I mean, we could argue why that is, or maybe just G1 Climax just finally had a name that registered with people for whatever reason. I mean, obviously they took the International Wrestling Grand Prix branding and of course made it their title belt for the most part in New Japan. So I mean, this one's kind of set it apart, and time was when G1 Climax was its own prestige to win G1 Climax. It wasn't just, a shot at Wrestle Kingdom. It was its own prestige. To be the G1 Climaxer was a big
deal.
Yeah. And it still is, don't get me wrong. But it just, I think now it seems like winning G1 Climax is like a step to,
Yeah, essentially. Right.
So, Chris, do you have any thoughts on this?
I think you guys summarized it really well, to be honest. Anything else that I probably would say in this case would end up being like ad nauseum repeats. So, no, it's a good job all around.
So, in any event, we can definitely recommend that you see the G1 Climax Final, which is on NJPW World, as is Chono's win the next year, where he defeated Rick Rude. In the final,
oh man,
that was a good match as well.
That is a classic
one to see as well. So we have now covered the inaugural G1 Climax from 1991, and I don't know if I mentioned this at the top of the show. This is going to be only the first part of a thematic 2-part.
It's G1 season after all.
It is G1 season, and when we record in August, which is still G1 season, traditionally, August is G1 season, when we come back in August for this show, we're going to do another G1 Climax. We're going to go over the best-reviewed edition of the tournament in the modern times when we do G1 Climax 24 from 2014.
God, probably my favorite tournament that I've watched from start to finish, to be completely honest.
It's definitely one of mine, and yeah, so in any event, so stay tuned for that in the month of August. Our producer, of course, is Chris Damasceno, who is with us here today.
Hi.
Chris, do you have anything you need to plug, or...
No, nothing too crazy. I mean, I'm just over on Twitter at Brazilian Fury. That's Brazilian with an S instead of a Z. Nothing really else direly important to plug that I can think of it.
Lawrence.
No, I have nothing. I just have myself and I.
You haven't done another edition of the Untitled Wrestling Podcast recently?
No, Ian just moved to New York now, so he's like, kind of like settling down. So,
gotcha. All right. Well, I'm sure there'll be one to come in the near future. For my part, of course, you can find me at Strong Style Story without the E in Style. I run the blog at strongstylestory.tumblr.com. We also do host the Strong Style Story podcast here at Place to Be Nation in the first and only bar podcast feed. And I'm also the co-host of Busting Balls, which is a soccer-related podcast. You can listen to that at soundcloud.com/busting-balls. And we just recorded episode 4 of that. So we'll be posting that here within the week as the World Cup has come to an end, but the domestic league seasons are starting to ramp up in Europe and elsewhere. So on behalf of myself, Lawrence O'Brien, and Chris Damasceno, thanks for listening to episode 15. We've made it 15 episodes of Strong Style History, guys.
Woo! Wow. And I feel like that many.
Right now, my goal is to make 20, and I already know what the topic's going to be for episode 20. I think you guys probably know what it's going to be, too, because I've been sitting on this one for ages, mm-hmm. champing at the bit. But we'll get to that in due time. So when we return in August with episode 16 of this program, we're going to cover G1 Climax 24 from 2014. So please stay tuned for that. And please keep listening to it. All the other great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation and the Pro Wrestling Only More podcast feed. Thanks for listening. Take care. Goodbye.